The Holy Gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ according to Mark.
Glory to you, Lord Christ.
From there, Jesus and his followers went through Galilee. But he didn't want anyone to know it. This was because he was teaching his disciples, "The human one will be delivered into human hands. They will kill him. 3 days after he is killed, he will rise up." But they didn't understand this kind of talk, and they were afraid to ask him. They entered Capernaum. And when they had come into a house, he asked them, "What were you arguing about during the journey?" They didn't respond, since on the way they had been debating with each other about who was the greatest. He sat down, called the 12, and said to them, "Whoever wants to be first must be least of all, and the servant of all." Jesus reached for a little child, placed him among the 12, and embraced him. Then he said, "Whoever welcomes one of these children in my name welcomes me. And whoever welcomes me isn't actually welcoming me, but rather the one who sent me." The Gospel of the Lord.
Praise to you, Lord Christ.
Welcoming children. Jesus told us to welcome the little children in his name. That's not so hard for us, is it? I mean, this past week, I received an email from several of you called "Life is Beautiful." And it has all these great illustrations of people doing acts of kindness. And one of the examples is of a father in business clothes, soaked to the skin in the pouring rain, holding his umbrella over his precious son so that the sun stays dry. In the opinion of the person who created this list, this email, life is beautiful when every parent knows that their child comes first. Nothing shocking about this, is there? Makes us feel pretty good. The thing is, in the context of the gospel, Jesus wasn't interested in the least in making the 12 feel pretty good. Each time in the Gospel of Mark that Jesus talks about his death and his rising, he then gathers them and teaches them about discipleship. They must turn from being captive to the way humans get what they want, which is to be forceful, violent to the point of murder, and instead they need to embrace the way of God, the author of life, who wins by defeating death and by serving others, not coercing them. Jesus tells the 12 they must get off the ladder of ambition because upward mobility is not a Christian goal. God's way is for everyone to commit to serving everyone else. Jesus takes a little child who can do nothing for an adult and tells these big grown men that their job is to serve this useless person. Now, as sweet as this picture of the dad is, and I love it, the truth is that our society has said that teaching and caring for children is not actually very valuable. How much do teachers get paid? Real work, valuable work, productive work is to make things, especially money. And our culture lionizes those who earn the most. According to that infamously liberal publication, Forbes magazine, on average, in 2017, corporate CEOs earned 361 times more than the average worker. It's these uber-rich CEOs who have vast influence in our political system, which is quite successfully helping the very wealthy get even more. Now, my point is not to demand anything of our current system of capitalism, but to contrast the teachings of this system with the teachings of Jesus. Today, the airwaves are stuffed with people arguing, using ugly, violent, abusive language against each other, all for the purpose of being the one who gets to call the shots in the system. What would we say if Jesus were to turn to us as we are polarizing ourselves and say, "What were you arguing about?" When Jesus takes that little child in his arms, he was making his point using the least worthwhile, the least admirable person in that house. He's saying that a useless, needy child is more representative of God than any politician, CEO, military hero, or talking head. Karl Barth, widely regarded as the greatest Protestant theologian of the 20th century, took this point to its logical, challenging, faithful end. He says, on the basis of the eternal will of God, we have to think of every human being, even the oddest, most villainous, or miserable, as one to whom Jesus Christ is brother and God is father. No other attitude to any kind of fellow humans is possible. It is identical with the practical acknowledgement of their human rights, their human dignity. To deny it to them would be for us to renounce having Jesus Christ as our brother and God as our father. So, who is a little child to a disciple of Jesus? Well, how about these children in immigration detention centers? And before you think I'm getting all political, this isn't current events. It's a way we've done things for a very long time. This story is from 2014, over 4 years ago. I could show you photos of Japanese kids in our internment camps in the 1940s, or Jewish kids in German concentration camps, or kids in Soviet gulags. Humans have been doing this kind of thing to each other for a very long time. We are certainly entitled, as a sovereign country, to use the system of keeping the useless riffraff out. I wonder, though, as Cindy reminded us last week, our founding fathers were Christians. What if, as we debate immigration policies, they came and they asked us, what are you arguing about? Well, I could put up thousands of pictures of suffering children in war-torn countries and refugee camps. I could put up thousands of pictures of suffering adults as well. And besides making you sad and feel guilty, I don't think it would accomplish much. So I'm not going to do it. What I am going to do is acknowledge how very difficult it is to want with all of one's heart, to be a disciple. To be a disciple, but to also want to be a winner in our everyday life. James knew about our predicament. He knows what we are taught by our culture to do. To follow what he calls earthly wisdom, to jostle for position and status, to compare ourselves against others, to want our piece of the pie, to be the one who dies with the most toys, to grab for the gusto. James asks us not to judge each other, but to look at ourselves. What do we really want? What do we really want? To satisfy our cravings or to have the mind of Christ? To submit to God? To do God's will on earth? To do it single-mindedly? Which means all the time, even out in the world. To do God's will, we need to use heaven's wisdom, the wisdom from above, as James calls it. And this wisdom guides us first, says James, into being pure, to keeping our heart, mind, and body out of the gutter. What do you read? What do you watch on TV? What do you put in your body? What comes out of your mouth? If you wonder whether it's pure, here's a simple test. Ask yourself if you'd invite Jesus over to join you doing it. Wisdom from above is peaceful and gentle, says James. Disciples make peace. They wage peace. There's more peace when they're done than when they began. Waging peace and being gentle means being kind to jerks, to help people who don't deserve it, to forgive enemies, to pray for them, to declaw and soothe that raging, angry lion of simmering rage that seems to be right beneath the surface of so many people today. Remember, you don't have to like anyone to be kind to them. To paraphrase what Jesus said last week, to tolerate people you agree with is easy. Tolerating the intolerable, intolerant people? Now, that's some hard work. But I think that's what God does with regard to humanity every single minute of every day. Am I right? Ah, but what about Jeremiah? Jeremiah is demanding revenge on his enemies. But think about it. What was God's revenge for this prophet who called on Israelites to stop their child sacrifices, to stop their political intrigues, to follow God? Was it to kill those plotting to wipe Jeremiah's memory off the face of the earth so no one remembered his name? No, God's revenge was to uphold justice against the unjust. Remember, justice is when the world is the way God created it to be, without human sin messing it up. God's revenge for Jeremiah was to have Jeremiah's name remembered, to have his words remembered. We are still reading from the book of Jeremiah, are we not? I would wager to say that every day someone says Jeremiah's name. Can anyone in this room tell me the names of those who were plotting against Jeremiah? I can't. God's revenge is that the call to live justly still rings out. The call to live justly is the call to use the wisdom from above. It's how things are in heaven. Wisdom from above is also obedient. This can mean a good number of things, but there's one thing I've noticed that's happening more and more. I wonder if you have too. So many people seem to think that the rules apply to everyone but them. Don't want to stand in line? Ditch. Literally push your way to the front. Don't like how slowly the person in front of you is driving? Pass them, and the heck with the double yellow lines. Those lines are for losers. Can't find a parking place close enough? Park in a handicap spot. If a critical mass of people each think they're so special that they don't need to be obedient to the rules, what we'll get is chaos. Obedience, graciously sharing common space, is one of the ways we serve each other. Now, finally, wisdom from above is filled with mercy, good actions. It's fair and genuine. It means give people a break. Do the right thing. Treat others as you want to be treated. Be real, straightforward. Don't be two-faced. Don't gossip. Imagine what the world would be like if we served each other like that. James then promises that the disciples who do this, who make peace this way, who wage peace this way, sow the seeds of justice by their peaceful acts. They're doing God's work. Wage peace, will get justice, a healed, complete creation. Now I'm going to tell a story from my sabbatical. It's hardly earth-shaking, but it taught me something about using the wisdom from above in a very practical situation. I was planning to stay in Edinburgh, Scotland for 3 nights, and I asked a person who lives in Scotland, another Anglican priest, for a hotel recommendation in Edinburgh, and she said, oh, get an Airbnb, it's much cheaper. And, you know, Gus and I have used Airbnb here in the States, so sure, fine. So I got on Airbnb, and I found a super host with 5 stars, and it included breakfast, a gluten-free breakfast. It was also in the family's flat. So I'd be with a real family that lived in flat number 5 on Forest Road, right in the heart of Edinburgh near the castle, and right around the corner from the place where J.K. Rowling wrote the Harry Potter books. I flew to Glasgow, got there early on a Monday morning, got the train to Edinburgh, and it was chilly, because, you know, it's mid-June, it's chilly there. It was bright, it was pretty day. And at this point, I'm traveling all by myself. Gus isn't going to be there for 2 more weeks. I got off the train at Edinburgh Waverley Station. I followed the map on my phone to the place where I was staying, 37 Forest Road. No problem. I found Forest Road. And I find 35 Forest Road. It's a coffee shop. I find 39 Forest Road. It's a thrift store. It's a thrift store that supports an agency for the homeless. Cool. But where is 37? Where is 37 Forest Road? There's only one choice, and it's this door. Covered with graffiti, no number on it. I did not like this at all. But I thought of the 5-star Airbnb reviews, the Superhost rating, and I was on this sabbatical to do new things, right? To do things I'd never done before. So how do you meet new people, do new things? So the intercom post on the door jamb. And I have to remember, like, Friends and Seinfeld, because I'm a suburban girl. I don't know about these flat things. And I remember you push a button, and then they'll talk to you. So I find a button with a 5 next to it, and I push it, and a male voice says, "Hello?" And they said, "Kevin, who wants to know?" It's Becky. I reserved a room through Airbnb. "Oh, right, I've been waiting for you. Come on up." The buzzer buzzes, and I'm still pretty leery of this graffiti-infested door. I push it open. I leave the bright daylight to this. It is so dark, I can't see a thing, at least not until my eyes adjust. But I have a phone, so I got the flashlight out on my phone and got this. Still not a very reassuring sight, but it didn't smell. It didn't smell, so I head toward the stairs. And I hear a door open somewhere way up above, and Kevin's voice, "It's just up here, 3 flights. I'll wait for you." So I trudge up with my backpack and my tote. I round the last corner, and I see a huge tattooed man. Now, this is not actually Kevin, but it could be his twin brother. I almost turned on my heels and bolted down the stairs. But 5-star reviews, super host rating, purposes sabbaticals to meet new people. I knew no one like Kevin. Kevin holds the door open for me, and I walk into the flat. Well, Kevin was the nicest guy. He runs a security company for pubs. In our country, we would call them bouncers. This evidently is the look for bouncers around the world. This is actually a picture of a bouncer in Washington, D.C. Now, I wouldn't know about these things because the kinds of places I hang out don't have bouncers. Anyway, it turns out that Kevin and his wife, Sarah, are teetotaling vegans. We had a number of wonderful talks, including one late at night over tea about faith and Jesus and what it means to live as a Christian in a crazy world. And this was a talk with two people who had not been in a church since they'd been baptized as babies. When I left, I gave him 5 stars. I did suggest that he talk to his landlord about painting the door and at least putting a number on it. But if I had judged the book of Kevin by its cover, if I'd bolted, I would have hurt Kevin's feelings pretty badly. I would not have shared my faith in Jesus with 2 hungry people who really didn't have anyone else to talk to this kind of stuff about. I don't think I converted them. I don't think they start going to church next week, but I think I planted a seed. I hope I did. Worst of all, if I'd bolted, I wouldn't have 2 friends in Edinburgh right now, would I? And look how others served me, people I'll never meet. I mean, Kevin and Sarah opened their home to me, but how about those people who gave Kevin the 5-star review and made him be a super host? They helped me do something new, to be at least a little brave and trusting. These were good actions, fair and genuine. All of us together, even though we didn't know each other, waged some peace and sowed some seeds of justice. And this very benign, kind of almost silly episode showed me that in my 64 years, I haven't pushed myself into very many places where I'm uncomfortable. James asks us to make up our minds. What are you going to do? What are you going to do with the one wild and precious life God has given? Shall we argue, struggle, fight over things and ideas that we can't take into eternity? Or will we submit to God, draw close to God, do some things that might make us uncomfortable, serve and welcome people we don't agree with, serve and welcome the little ones who can't do anything for us, but whom Jesus embraces, because Jesus embraces everyone. Serve the little ones who can't do anything for us, but whom Jesus embraces and over whom God the Father holds an umbrella of love.